everybody, and welcome to MILF Talk. I'm Sophie, and I'm full of it. Free advice, that is. My name is Sophie Venable, and I'm a psychologist, life coach, author, and mother of two. MILF stands for Make Your Life Fabulous, and we like to talk about anything here, from parenting and money issues to sex and dating. And today's guest might just bring up a little bit of all of that. My lovely guest today is an MFT, that's marriage and family therapist, for those of you who don't know, who specializes in sex therapy and is currently working toward becoming a certified sex therapist through ASECT, which basically means she's working her ass off, people.
It sounds too busy.
She's really busy, okay?
Yep.
Please welcome, ladies and gentlemen, Shireen Harari. Yay! Yay! Woo!
Thank you. Ow!
Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And once again, we have in the peanut gallery the guy that likes to just come and hang and chat with the ladies.
Hi.
Ladies and gentlemen, the charming and talented Todd Anderson.
Woo! Hi, ladies.
Yeah. All right.
How's it going?
We're so glad you're here, Todd.
Oh, thanks for having me.
It's always nice to have you here.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
Anthony's here, too. You
know? Yeah.
Hey.
Hey, Anthony. Hey.
Another boy.
It's nice to have boys in the house.
Yeah.
Yes. So, Shireen.
Yes.
Tell us about sex therapy. Actually, did I say Hariri? Or did I say Harari?
You, whatever,
I don't know,
it,
whatever
is,
it is. It's Hariri.
It's okay. Hariri.
It's yeah. All good.
Because I don't remember.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It's all good.
So, what is sex therapy and who needs it?
Well, from a sex therapy perspective, everybody needs it on some level because we all have some relationship with sex.
Right. Well, that is true.
Yeah.
Yes.
I saw an episode of Simon and Simon when I was a kid where AJ had a sex therapist and she had sex with him. Is that how it works?
No, that's okay. Not what's supposed to happen, in fact.
That's what happened on Simon and Simon, though.
That sounds like a breach of ethics.
Sounds like the
80s. Yeah. Or the 70s,
or the
maybe,
70s.
Yes, if that was actually
the heyday, certainly.
Right. Yeah. So we'll get to that later, but okay, because we don't want to confuse people.
No,
I would, I think that one of the reasons I used to hate the term life coach a lot, but in a way I prefer it now because, well, one, I'm not an MFT, so I can't legally call myself that. Two, because there's a little less stigma around it, and I think that sometimes couples, whether it's about money or parenting or sex or whatever, they feel that it's some grand, horrible statement about their relationship that they might need counseling, that they might need a therapist, a third party to sort of help them sort through things. And I would love to, educate people about that and let them know what the process is really like. The fact that it's most couples going into therapy are already done. They go too late. There's already one person that's done. I mean, wouldn't you say that?
Absolutely true.
80%, if not more, like by the time you get there, they're already
To fix it.
Yeah.
So people are using therapy as a last-ditch effort.
Exactly. Instead of sort of a tool that can be used throughout their relationship that they have to go back to that can really, help them communicate. So I'd love for people to really understand what it means or why somebody might choose somebody that specializes in sex therapy or, when that would be the go-to choice.
Yeah. So... I think a lot of times people go to a regular therapist and assume that they're not going to be able to talk about sex at all. So many regular therapists are like not willing, I guess, to say certain words and talk about certain things. And by the time...
Penis, vagina.
Really? Therapists don't talk about sex? Like
a lot of... when I see somebody, when I get a client, a lot of times they've said, I tried to talk about this with my therapist, but she got really squeamish and... So I just
really,
yeah,
that doesn't sound professional at all.
Just like all professions, they come in all.
They do, they do. And so, I think there's such a need for somebody to be a sex therapist. And when that couple or individual walks into the room, they know that this person is going to be okay with pretty much anything they say,
right.
And that includes anything from my penis isn't working to I want to be spanked really hard, and my partner doesn't want to do that. Or I like this other thing that my partner doesn't like, or whatever it is. A lot of times they will come in and say, my therapist is like, we never talked about sex, and I saw my therapist for 5 years.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. So yeah, and your response is the same as if they said, "I want to go rock climbing," and my partner doesn't, and you could just talk about it and say, "Well, so how do you feel about that? What are you afraid of, and what are you concerned about?"
Yeah. It's a non-issue for a sex therapist typically. I mean, obviously everybody's got their stuff, but when somebody goes through this process and is interested in helping people with sex, we've already gotten to a point where it's almost like penis and vagina or whatever. It's just another bunch of words.
Right.
Another bunch of topics.
Yeah, I worked with a client when I was interning who was in there court ordered for molestation. Mm-hmm. And it was actually going really well, but for me, I felt personally that I had to split off, mm-hmm. you know, internally mm-hmm. to be in the room with him. And I just didn't feel like it was healthy for me. So I had to transfer him to another therapist. I mean, I think we all have our limits, you know, at a certain point. Yeah. But I wish I could have, you know, helped him more, I suppose. But, you know, I just think it's important to know your limits. Yeah. So somebody who decides to go into sex therapy, you've done extra work, mm-hmm. and you've definitely decided that you are okay with being in the room and talking about these things. So somebody can really feel safe with you.
One would hope. I mean, you know, we try to go through as much training as possible, especially when we get certified. We know that there's the standard of training that we now have. A lot of people can call themselves a sex therapist without that training, but, you know, you can say anything you want to say. But
what is the additional training that sex therapists go through?
The additional training I go through and most certified sex therapists go through is something through this organization called ASECT, the American Association of Certified Sex Educators, counselors, and therapists.
That's it.
And it's actually
looked it up.
Very good. Bravo. Better than I did. And you know, we do 250 or maybe now it's 300 hours with clients. So it's like it's like getting another license, except it's a shorter time frame than getting MFT. Yeah. Which can take years. But in this case with ASECT, I've done my 250 hours, I've done all my supervision around it, and then we have about 150 educational hours, like learning about human sexuality and how to be a sex therapist, and a few other hours here or there that we have to do, and I've done most of that. So I feel like I can call myself a sex therapist because I'm maybe 20 hours away from being fully done with this process. And so what that
means...
We're
going to call you that.
Please do.
Okay. Shireen, the sexy sex therapist.
Yeah. There it is.
There you go. Ding.
Okay. So what this means to be a sex therapist for me means that I've got the training and I've also got the open-mindedness to not have somebody in front of me that I get all weirded out about if they say, so I in fact do have some people that I see who are pretty much pedophiles, maybe have even been arrested for something.
Yeah.
My way of doing it is I'm not going to judge them. I might have my own thoughts and feelings about it, but I can also see the humanity in most of these people, unless they're sociopathic or, you know, there's something else getting in the way.
Yes.
So having empathy and being able to help them.
Yeah, I think I could probably do that now. I wasn't in a place where I could do that then.
Yeah. Yeah. Of course.
But the majority, now do you work with a lot of singles or couples or
It's pretty split down the middle.
Yeah.
You know, it really depends. Somebody who is having a quote-unquote sexual dysfunction based on whatever the DSM calls a sexual dysfunction might come in by themselves or with their partner. It's really split down the middle. I think it's also gender-wise split down the middle. Sexual orientation, plenty across the board. So it's a good demographic. I think I have to say Caucasian people tend to seek sex therapy more than anyone else.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that...
Coming from a very Caucasian.
I'm as white as they get.
He's glaring. I need sunglasses. So I think that there's a trust factor in other cultures. You know, I think that plenty of other cultures have non-Caucasian cultures have difficulty opening up, you know, feeling safe.
Yes.
But, you know, whoever comes in, mm-hmm. and we talk very openly. You know, they're expecting me to know what I'm talking about. They're expecting to be able to say words like penis and vagina and sex and, you know, the F-bomb and things like that.
Right.
And
so generally, even in so in your first, because you present this way in your first session, mm-hmm. you can sort of sit down and really say, so why are you really here? You mm-hmm. know, and if a couple says, well, we've been going to therapy, or an individual says, I've been in therapy for 5 years, I haven't been able to talk about sex with my therapist. You might as well just go right into that piece of it, you know?
Yeah, dive right in.
Dive right in.
So to speak.
Yes.
Yeah. And,
Serene.
And so when people come in, they tend to be very tense, because everyone they've tried to talk about this with has been very tense with them. And
sure.
My thing, and I think a lot of sex therapists, we really want people to feel comfortable, and we normalize the conversation about sex and, hey, okay, just asking these questions. Sometimes you know that they're skittish. You have to kind of say, if ever I say something that feels a little bit too violating or too far for you, please let me know. I'll dial it back. But generally speaking, they know that they can say whatever, and they're not going to be judged. And I really like that for them,
yeah,
as well as for myself.
Right, because you're a loving and empathetic, compassionate person. You're, you know.
Yeah.
You're doing this to help people have a better quality of life.
Yeah.
Right? Because, you know, like we've talked about in the last episode, it's been a little while since we talked about it, but Todd, Aaron, and you and I were talking about couples and, you know, being able to talk about what you want sexually mm-hmm. and really feeling safe. And you know, there was a piece, because we sort of got distracted. I don't know how.
What?
But there was a piece of that we didn't get to the other side of. There was one part, side of the coin where I said, well, because you said, well, what if you want something that your partner just doesn't want, you know? And mm-hmm. and it's, well, you know, sometimes that can drive you apart, you know? Sometimes it can. Sometimes mm-hmm. it can. But the flip side of it, too, is sometimes just being able to say it or talk about it or know that it's okay that you think it can increase your internal freedom and your feeling of intimacy so much that you don't even have to act on it. You know, there are sometimes, like a very simple example would be if a guy, you know, really wants to have a threesome and his wife is like, hey, that is never
happening. Imagine a guy wanting to have a threesome.
I know. Shocking. Never happens.
You mean with two women, right?
Yeah,
that's what you mean.
Two women or two men, whatever. But some guys are,
guys are
bi-curious. You know, they're a bit, nobody talks about it. And
I don't want to talk about that.
Okay, well, we won't. Anthony, do you want to talk about that? No, okay, good. So, simple example. However, if he can even get to the point with his wife where it's okay to even talk about it in bed or fantasize about it or, you know, notice other women or whatever, they may never, ever have a threesome, but it may be fun to talk about. And there may be a level of internal freedom there that creates more intimacy between the two of them. Right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that was the other side of it. I didn't want to just like leave people with, and by the way, if your spouse doesn't want to do that, you're probably done.
Right.
That's not, you know, the final answer.
Right.
So I'd be curious. I mean, if you have any, you know, interesting kind of like real simple examples of what a couple mm-hmm. might come up with, or, you know, what can be the most real complicated? Because I would imagine you have to work with their doctors too in some cases.
Sometimes,
right?
Yeah. I mean, as far as that part goes, depending on what's going on, usually they come to me already having ruled out something medical.
Okay,
if they haven't, like if a man comes in with a erectile dysfunction-y sort of thing, I might send him to a urologist to get checked out. And he'll still come back, yeah, you're clear. You're
everything's fine.
Yeah, everything's fine. It's all in your head. But typically, like I have a couple right now that I'm seeing who came in because a couple years ago, he had mentioned that he wanted to expand the relationship a little bit and maybe play with others, like bring in another couple, swing. And she basically was having none of it, but she didn't say anything about it. So two years pass, she did some things. She didn't like it.
Oh, so they went forward with
it. They went forward
with
it.
Okay. Oh.
But she didn't say anything like, I'm monogamous. I don't want to do this. So it really, really spiraled. And by the time they got to me, they were, you know, it's savable. But, you know, the part of the problem is that she just was too scared, I think, or too upset or whatever it was to share her truth and be authentic and be intimate with him, which is really what he was looking for and what she's looking for. She just didn't understand how to do that. So part of our therapy
is
communication.
Yeah, that would be tricky. Yeah. That would be.
Yeah. So that kind of thing actually happens a lot in various forms where one of them wants to expand into some form of non-monogamy and the other one is totally scared to say no, but does it, and then it just goes awry in various ways. It's very common, at least for who I see, it's very common.
Interesting. So, yeah, that would be... Yeah, that's interesting that one side of the couple can mm-hmm. come and say, this is something that I'm interested in. Mm-hmm. I wonder, was she a good actress or did he just choose not to tune in to what was going on with her? And I guess that would be probably her resentment is sort of, you didn't read my mind.
Yeah.
Well, and it sounds like she said yes initially because she was afraid of what we talked about in the last podcast of having a rift in the relationship if she wasn't with that sort of thing.
Yeah. And if she can understand that in our therapy, you know, part of this is saying, well, the rift is going to happen. It's just going to happen differently and more slowly if you don't communicate, and you're going to feel awful about your relationship.
Well, yeah, then you're literally having sex you don't want to have.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and then how do you can't unring that bell.
Yeah.
You know, that's really, you know, planned non-monogamy, like what you're talking about here, can really work for some couples.
It can.
But if you don't speak up, the reality of what's going to happen is that you're going to be having sex with other people. Okay, let's say the woman, okay, isn't the one that's not want to do it. You know, you're going to be having men on top of you that you don't want on top of you.
Exactly.
Or even if you do, you're not sure why you don't want. Like, even if you're attracted to them, you're not in that experience. Yeah. And that's awful.
Yes.
Awful. Yes. And I don't think your partner really wants that for you. So
One would hope not.
Well, I mean, if your partner needs to get laid so badly that they are really willing to kind of throw you under the bus, so to speak, that way, there's way bigger problems in the relationship.
That's true. And that happens too.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Definitely.
But wow, I mean, that's pretty intense.
It is.
A lot to untangle.
It's a lot to untangle. And especially, you know, a lot of times, stuff has really happened. So she's been, maybe it's not swinging, maybe it's kink, maybe it's whatever, you know, but she's been doing something she didn't like. She's been getting more and more tense in her body. She's been becoming more and more resentful, more and more shut down. He's noticing something's wrong. He's trying to overcompensate by doing more of this thing that he thought would fix it to begin with. And then
interesting.
Now her body is in a place where she's starting to feel a trauma response, you know, and that could be whatever it is. Sometimes it ends up being genital pain, vaginismus, you know, where her whole body is just so shut down reflexively that now we're also dealing with having to reverse the effects of that.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, my hope is always that people maybe find me online before it gets too bad or find a person to talk to before it gets too bad. But really a lot of this has to do with a lack of maybe self-esteem or skills in communication or willingness.
Absolutely.
You know, if a person didn't have parents that helped them be able to say safely, hey, I like this, I don't like this, this is, makes me feel uncomfortable, then they don't have the tools, you know? And let's say it's a woman who's in that position. And by the way, it's not always a woman. It's often flipped.
I would imagine it would be flipped also because men would be very territorial of their woman.
It could be.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. They could be very, like...
It can happen.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
So I don't care how many women I get to screw. This is not okay with me.
This feels weird. It's okay for me, but not for you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you can imagine all the ripple effects of just the first moment where one of them said, hey, I'd like to do this, and the other one did not attuned to themselves enough to say what was true for them.
Right. And if there is a history of not necessarily speaking up about anything, whether it's, you know, swinging or paint colors, it's, you know, then he's got the same response that he's always gotten. Yeah. So he assumes everything's okay.
Yeah.
You know, I mean,
what's the percentage of, you know, people, because that sounds like a communication breakdown thing.
Yeah.
Like, and you talked about sexual dysfunction before. I mean, what's the percentage of sexual dysfunction that you deal with that's actually physical or manifests itself physically, and then just couples working their stuff out, or even the individual who's not necessarily there with the other person who's talking about that, like, rift in the relationship?
You know, I can't say a percentage, but because it really fluctuates depending on the month, you know, but it's certainly all of the above happens. in a couple or in the aftermath of a couple, maybe they've broken up and now I'm seeing an individual, a lot of it is communication based and sort of codependency-ish based and lack of tools and skills. But dysfunction does end up playing a role a lot of the time. So let's say there's a couple, the same couple I'm talking about, where this happened and it kind of spiraled. You know, by the time I see them, sexual dysfunction, so she might have the vaginismus, she might have genital pain. He might have an erectile dysfunction or early ejaculation because now he's anxious about doing it right or whatever. So, you know, those are sort of the two primary things. But then also libidos might drop, you know, then she sort of shut down her sexual flow or he has. And even if at some point the communication's better, everything's better, now we're still dealing with that after effect. So how do you get the body on a very organic level to flow differently hormonally? Chemically,
what do you do? What do you tell them? You just, I mean, because when there's a communication breakdown, obviously you're helping them reestablish that line of communication.
Yeah.
So, but that's not necessarily a fix-all, is it? Because once the communication's established, then there's still you could be communicating a genuine difference in desire.
Yeah. Well, you can certainly be communicating that, and we have to assess, like, is this couple, are they willing to kind of meet together someplace in a, like, a Venn diagram sort of way? Like, where is the overlap between his template and her template? And if that's enough for both of them, then it all works out and we can negotiate it.
Like, the overlap in my example would have been, I can talk about it and want a threesome and we can fantasize about it in bed. And your overlap is you're okay with that, you know, with talking about it. That could be the only overlap, you know,
where the
rest of it doesn't overlap. Like, that's not okay with both of us.
Absolutely.
Right? Okay.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. And then I would imagine, you know, physically you've got to get, and one of the things we've talked about a lot too is just, you know, the level, maintaining that level of affection in the relationship and the sexual tension just between the two of you. So I would imagine, particularly in this example, I would imagine that the intimacy between them needs to be completely reestablished before it can be shared with anybody else.
Yeah, or, I mean, certainly sufficiently reestablished. I mean, it's intimacy, it's trust, it's communication. You know, with a couple, a lot of it is you're doing couples therapy first, and then you're doing the sex therapy later.
Right.
Because sex therapy is not going to help at all. It's just going to be re-triggering for them as a couple or as individuals if the foundation isn't kind of better.
Right.
You know.
So you have to start repairing the relationship and then you talk about the sex.
To a point, yeah. I mean, you have to assess it. So a couple comes in, the first couple, 2 to 3 sessions are usually kind of an intake process of getting to know them a little bit better. And then kind of intuitively, but also based on what they're saying, I might come up with some kind of a treatment plan that includes something that I would tell them, like, okay, it sounds like you guys really need to sort of reestablish a connection to begin with. And I don't know that we're going to be able to talk about the rest of it until you can sit more than 5 feet apart on the couch, you know, and
your penis will not reach all the way over there.
No, exactly.
That would be really, really long. That's not going to work.
Yeah,
that guy would be famous.
He would be. Maybe not in a good way.
Not in a good way.
Maybe not. Infamous, then.
There you go. Yeah, so, I mean, we have to look at each couple. We have to figure out, like, what is the primary problem here? Sometimes the primary problem is that he has a low libido, and that's just hormonal, and it's turned into this, oh, now he doesn't like me, she doesn't like me.
Sure, you know? And that's the issue with the layers, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just the layers of meaning that we pile on to everything, you know? And sometimes, I'll throw this out at you, actually, because I sort of have this theory.
Lay it on
that
me.
If your man really doesn't have a libido, like if there's really something going on in your marriage where he doesn't want to have sex, most likely, not 100%, he's either not well, you know, on some level, whether it's, you know, stress, low hormones, not sleeping, sick, you know, something going on, depressed, okay, actually, you know, chemically depressed, or cheating, you know, getting it elsewhere, or masturbating too much or something. But I mean, you know, getting it elsewhere.
Wait, you can masturbate too much?
Oh, Todd.
A what?
If you're masturbating so much that you're forgetting to pursue.
Oh, no.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, you're fine.
I'm fine. It's fine. I just wanted to check.
Yeah. No, you're all good. Right?
I need hard numbers.
Is that fair? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. 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 I mean, you know, you can masturbate too much. You can cause sores on your penis, so you don't want that. But
that's
as long
true.
As.
That's true.
That would be a
you
lot.
Don't want that.
Yeah. That's a lot.
That's
yeah.
like when you're getting friction burns. That's
exactly.
You have
but
carpal tunnel
is,
from
that's
masturbation.
That's what lube is for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's lube. Yeah, right?
It can help. But eventually you just have to stop masturbating.
Really?
That's really the only way out
That's
of that
That's the
one.
Saddest news I've ever
I'm
gotten.
I'm so sorry to break it to you.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. But
there's no swords yet, right?
No, not
you're
yet.
Good. You're fine. Yeah. Don't be sad.
Okay.
It's all good.
All right.
You're fine.
I'm just going to see how far I can take this
oh,
thing.
Oh, you go for it. Okay.
So yeah, so the layers in that
the
example
layers,
would be
yeah.
like it's about he's not into me, he's not that, you know, he's not and
yeah.
So, you know, that seems like that's sort of the neurotic's point of view of like, this is all about me. And sometimes you might have to get a little curious and say, mm-hmm. is there something going on for you? But it's scary to get that answer sometimes.
Yeah. You know, for that kind of thing, I mean, if something in the way that they present in the first session or two, a couple specifically, it tells me that maybe I need to do a session individually with each of them just to get a little more mm-hmm. detail.
Yeah.
Every so often I'll do that. Letting them know that there's no secret, you know, like we keep a very definite boundary about I'm not going to hold any major secrets. This is just so that you can speak more freely. But even if we don't do that, even if it's just couples therapy. So let's say the couple that you're talking about, like he has a lower libido
mm-hmm.
and she's getting more and more sort of upset and taking it personally and he won't really talk with her about it. There's all sorts of reasons why that could be going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're kind of on the right track. It could be something physiological, so he could go get his testosterone check, for example, or other hormones.
Mm-hmm.
He could just have one of those bodies that doesn't really have a lot of a high arousal level or mm-hmm. even what we would kind of quote-unquote call normal. He could be cheating. He could be watching excessive porn. Todd?
You mean, how do you mean excessive? You mean the kind
We've
of porn or the time the porn lasts? What are you,
is it
quantity?
Oh, you're
the
talking about quantity
of the porn
or the genre?
The genre?
Okay.
The
genre,
the intensity.
The genre can matter too.
Yeah,
the genre,
I would imagine
it
so.
Yeah. If their sex life has traditionally been, or what she wants is something more vanilla and he's watching super kinky stuff. Then he's just not being turned on by whatever it is that she is willing to do.
Right.
But there's also other stuff. Like for a man with a low libido, a lot of times we'll be dealing with codependency issues, we'll be dealing with emasculation, we'll be dealing with family of origin stuff, where I often find with men in particular who don't have a high sex drive or have an erectile difficulty, mm-hmm. either keeping an erection or ejaculating, we can kind of sometimes trace it back to a really overly critical mother.
Mm-hmm.
That actually happens. It's like in my
Pretty
practice
common.
Anyway, it's a common theme.
Mm-hmm.
So it might be that he just has an issue with women. He doesn't feel safe. He can't let go. He can't relax. Sometimes it's because he has like ADD and he can't focus. I mean, there's all sorts of, there's a long list of reasons why that could be. And part of my job is to know that list pretty well and assess for it in the first few sessions, but over time also.
How often is it religious upbringing?
That actually, for women more than men.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you know why?
Well, I think that for women, because just to be really blunt, in a lot of religious households and cultures, virginity until marriage is a really big deal.
Oh, of course.
Oh, that makes
and,
sense, yeah.
Yeah, and virginity is much more easily checked and discovered on the wedding night. For women versus mm-hmm. for men. So, you know, unless she's going to get a surgery to repair her hymen, he will know if she hasn't.
God.
Yeah, that does happen. So, you know, she's, I know, did your vagina just clench?
Like, hold on,
super glad I don't have a vagina right now.
I'm so happy for you. a lot of times I'll get, in particular, Middle Eastern women who come in having been virgins until marriage, having been told they would be considered a slut if they mm-hmm. had any extramarital sex prior to their wedding night. But there's no on-off switch here, right? So they get this negative message, they go to have sex, it's painful because they're terrified that they're going to be bad and maybe God will, you know, shun them or something, whatever their particular religious upbringing was. And then we're dealing with, like, how do you integrate sexuality sacredly
right,
with religion?
Right.
You know, so that happens a lot. It does happen with men as well. So I don't want to just say it's all women. It's just that there's this additional layer, I think, for women that has to do with the virginity specifically and the slut-shaming kind of stuff.
Right. Do you find that for men, some of it, has to do with their image of their wife and what they're, how they're allowed to.
Oh, like a virgin whore complex thing?
Yeah, well, yeah, like sort of, you know, we're married and so it's okay to have sex now. And, you know, but it can't be too slutty. Like it can't be too nasty.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Or.
Sure. I think that comes up. You know, although the Madonna
probably not
whore
enough to end up in the therapist's office.
Yeah. I mean, obviously there's all sorts of incarnations of this. So I'm really overgeneralizing when I say that, you know, typically he would actually love her to be more wild in bed as soon as they're married.
But, well, like, in, you know, this example, sure.
In this example, or it's in, like, these
isn't
examples.
This great, mm-hmm. you know, for both of us.
But are there a lot of examples of, you know, the opposite? You know, that Madonna whore thing? I mean, how often does that happen?
It happens all the time. It's so ingrained in our society, culturally, religiously. It's a really common theme. You know, you can look at it in all sorts of ways. The dynamic, the duality of that. So there's this extreme and that extreme, Madonna versus whore. You can look at it as, like, love versus lust. You can look at, you know, there's, like, this big gap between these two things. And a lot of, especially religious, but not just religious communities, there is a huge difference between loving someone and what the responsibility of love is versus lust.
Yes.
And in love, there's very little space for hotness and desire a lot of the time. You know,
which is tragically,
it is.
Yeah, why is that?
I think it would be amazing if more women walked into your office or my office and said, "I wanna, you know, untangle this Madonna whore thing for myself." Mm-hmm. Because once you do it for yourself, then whatever
you're gonna,
right?
Yeah. You know, then whatever, then you'll just find a different kind of guy.
Like, yeah,
you know, if somebody said, like, I really want to be able to address this with somebody that can really help me sort of untangle these two things because I am a good person. I am a loving person. And I'm also, you know, somebody who wants to be nasty in bed and I want to do that with the man that I love, you know? So how do I integrate these two things?
Is it that those things need to be compartmentalized or they do need to be integrated? What is the way of handling that?
Ideally speaking, everything would be integrated.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Compartmentalizing that stuff. I mean, you know, certainly for some people, you can look Madonna-ish outside of the bedroom. And when you walk into the bedroom, the whore can come out. But really what you're asking for is for the whore, quote unquote, to be within her wherever she goes. And the typically, you know, even if there's this complex, the Madonna whore complex, you're still looking at a man, say, who wants his wife to look at him a certain way outside of the bedroom to kind of flirt with him, tease him, remind him that he's got the hot woman that he's going to go into the bedroom with and have this great wild sex. So she is sort of put into this position of having to hold both as she's walking around. Mm-hmm. From a healthy sex perspective, I would love it if it was integrated, but just, you know, wherever it's appropriate to be one versus the other, but you do it with intention.
Right.
You know,
you can live very happily with having the two things compartmentalized in your action.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
The issue is the shame around one or the other.
Exactly.
Right?
Well,
usually the shame around
the one.
Yeah. So the issue is the shame. So they can become more blurred or integrated or intertwined depending on the situation if the shame is not in the way.
Absolutely.
But for some people, even that is compartmentalized. You know, out in the world, there's, you know, shame around it. But in the bedroom, everything is sort of safe.
Right.
In there. But that still has a thread of this is only okay here because it defines me a certain way. And so to lift that shame is really the goal.
Yeah. I think a lot, I mean, we have to remember that for some people, shame is actually an erotic template. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, if somebody gets turned on by having shame or being shamed, great, whatever it is.
But isn't that usually rooted in some sort of upbringing, religious upbringing, the shame thing?
Religious,
I mean,
or not.
Would you know? Would they find that shame thing without the religion? I wonder. I mean, does that happen?
Well, this goes into a much more sort of sociological conversation. I mean, mm-hmm.
I want answers, Shireen.
I know you do, Todd.
It's anthropology class now, damn it.
You know, if we can really, really simplify this and say that our society, more or less, most of this planet is shame-based in some way. And the thing about shame, it was important to recognize this. All of these emotions that we have, shame included, anger, whatever, these are the emotions we have. This is what's in the human body, in the human brain, and we have them, and what are we going to do with them? We can do it in a more healthy way. We can do it in a toxic way. So what is shame about? What is guilt about? These are the things that we're supposed to feel when we do something that hurts another person, that is mean or cruel or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we're supposed to feel kind of bad for the thing that we did. Mm-hmm. But we're not supposed to feel bad about ourselves because
for who we are.
And, you know, part of working with people who have this sort of cultural religious upbringing that super shames them for being sexual is to say, okay, from that perspective, what do you really think God wanted when he created you? He gave you sexuality. He gave you orgasm, you know, in most cases. He gave you these parts that are supposed to interlock a certain way, assuming we're talking heterosexual, and helping someone understand that whatever the story was that they heard about their sexuality growing up, that maybe they need to kind of back it up a little bit and think about what God would want for them. You know,
or what their truth is.
Well, the thing about it is that
but
when you're talking religiously,
it's
a different
part of it.
Exactly.
For them. Absolutely.
Exactly. So it's, you know, from my perspective, I would want them to be the primary decision maker in their own psyche. But that's not always going to be possible for them because they have chosen, for upbringing or not, to be riding shotgun basically with God and whatever they've decided that means to them.
Right, and they need to be able to integrate that into their own psyche to make that okay, so that they can integrate their sex life as part of their whole human experience and their whole experience in a spiritual way as well.
And about people who have lost their religion but still have those residual problems?
Well, we talk about
because
that.
Of upbringing.
Yeah,
how do you handle those? Because you're talking about integrating your spirituality and sexuality, and that's cool. But what if you don't have that spirituality, but you still have these lingering? I'm not trying to get free therapy, Shireen. Don't look at me like
that. Don't look at me like that. I think. Well, okay. You have to then honor that piece of it, right?
Yeah.
You have to then go.
Yeah,
down that path.
One of the core things about therapy, just typically, is we try to meet people more or less where they are. So if someone, say, comes in and has maybe lost a connection with religion and is still working with shame-based issues, we have to talk about what that means to them. Why? Where did it come from? You know, you do as much uncovering of it as you can and sort of help them see connections. Mm-hmm. What you actually do to help them overcome it really depends on them. You know, I mean, this is a great sort of overview to say someone comes in, they've kind of decided not to be religious, but they were brought up with the same sort of shame and guilt that whatever their family's religion was gave them. So, you know, it's a long conversation. These are sort of deeply rooted neural pathways that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But I try, and I think most sex therapists try to be really open about that and say, okay, well, you have deeply rooted neural pathways that you're trying to rewire. I might give them the example of some water, drops of water running down the side of a rock. And over time, they sort of etch into the rock this specific pathway. But that doesn't mean that you can't change the path of that water, you know. And the brain's neuroplasticity actually allows for a lot of changing of patterns. So we have to kind of say, okay, there's this goal. You're walking in here because you want to have a healthier relationship with sex. You don't want to feel shame. You want to feel open and free, or whatever it is that this person's goal is. I would say, okay, well, so what we're dealing with is a lot of wiring and a lot of need to rewire. Where did you come from? Where do you want to go? And how do we make that change? And then I might give them all sorts of little tools and tasks and whatever that they can do at home, exercises, reading, breathing exercises, meditation, whatever. I mean, it really depends on the situation. Mm.
So I think the thing to remember there too, for anybody who's you know, married and wondering why their sex life didn't magically work perfectly. Mm-hmm. See, you know, you have your own set of neural pathways, and so does your spouse.
Exactly.
And now you're trying to mix them up.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And we don't do a lot when we're in our 20s and dating of trying to really understand, you know, what's a little further behind the door there. And so, because it all just kind of works, you know, like in the beginning. And then as time goes by, you're creating more intimacy and you're going sort of further and further into the layers. And what I want to do now is I want to wrap up this episode, and then we're going to do a part two. And we can talk about some more, like, more specific issues. You know, we can get into some of the fun stuff. And this hasn't been fun. This has been fun. So thank you for listening. That's just this episode for right now. You can find me on Facebook as Sophie Venable. You can follow an occasional tweet on Twitter at MILF Talk. And actually, if you want some good old-fashioned advice and inspiration, my book will be available by the time that this airs on Amazon.com. And it's called MILF 101.
Can't wait.
So thank you for listening.